From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau. Thank you very much for listening today. On the first half of our show today, it's going to be devoted to COVID-19 as some startling new numbers have come out this week, and we'll learn more about how the community in the La Crosse area is reacting. Then later on, we'll talk about supporting the local food supply chain. Over the last few months, we've seen what happens when certain items are in scarce supply in the grocery store. We'll talk about it in the second half of today's show. Right now, we are going to hear from Jen Rombalski. She is the health director for the County of La Crosse. And what they've announced is, in light of dozens of new cases of COVID-19 confirmed in our listening area over the last week, they have raised an alert system that they're using to red, which is the severe risk category. Basically, I'm referring to the COVID-19 compass, which has four categories, and they're color-coded. I'm going to tell you what they are right now. The green color is low risk, yellow is moderate risk, orange, which we've been at more recently, is high risk, and then now this week we've been elevated to red, which is severe risk. Rombalski, in a press conference online this week, outlined to reporters and those watching online exactly what's entailed in the severe risk category.
We always want to stay home if we have any symptoms, so that stays the same across the board. If we look at leisure travel outside of La Crosse County, really there is no leisure travel that is recommended at this time. So after any leisure travel, the recommendation is that there would be a 14-day quarantine. Physical distancing and fabric face coverings while in public, the recommendation in the red severe risk column is to stay home unless you must go out. And then if you must go out, you should be physically distancing, and you should be wearing fabric face coverings. Attending social gatherings, different than in category orange high risk, where we had up to 15 indoors with the fabric face coverings and physical distance, we really should not have any gatherings outside of the household in this red category. Similarly, with outdoors, where we previously had 50 or fewer people with recommending the face covering or physical distance, the recommendation right now in our area, in our county, is 10 or fewer with fabric face coverings and physical distance, if outside. If you're visiting a restaurant or bar, again, inside versus outside, it really should just be takeout and curbside pickup. I will just note here that we do not have the ability to close down establishments. We do not have the authority to do that. So this really is supply and demand, that you have to make good choices about what you do. And if you're going to go to a restaurant or bar or any other location in our community, including grocery stores, you know, getting your hair done, anything in the community, there is going to be risk present. And it is really important for you to decrease travel wherever possible. Protecting yourself in the workplace, the recommendation is working from home whenever possible. If you must be in the workplace, then physical distance and wearing the fabric face covering is recommended at all times. I think where we say this may not be necessary is if you're in your own office space with walls and a ceiling and a door, then you are not in close contact with others. But any other space, including conference rooms, hallways, any communal locations, this is the recommendation. And really, attending personal care services at this time in red stage are not recommended.
Earlier on during Safer at Home, it was presumed that if the Supreme Court ever did throw out the Safer at Home order, or if it came to an end by reaching its natural end, that local county health officials would have the authority to establish their own rules in each of their own localities. While that is the case to a certain extent, Jen Rombalski, the county health director in La Crosse, tells reporters why she feels like she doesn't have the authority to make blanket rules in La Crosse County.
This is a tough question and one I struggle to answer, but ultimately it comes down to there is discrepancy across the state with regards to what authority health officers really have. And while some have chosen to take that action, many, many have not. And that is because, again, in the Safer at Home order, when the Supreme Court overturned that order, they identified specifically the statute that provides authority to health officers. I think it was specific to the state health officer authority, but it's very close to the local health officer authority. And it basically has led to a lot of conflict and discrepancy about what that authority really is. And we believe that we do not have the authority to write a health order at that level. We can write a health order if it is looking at a specific location. Perhaps they have not taken our recommendations, they continue to not protect the public, and maybe exposures have happened there and they happen again. We can write an order in some of those situations on a case-by-case basis. And then ultimately it's up to the health department to enforce that order. It would not be something that is enforceable by law enforcement. So I just wanna say that even if we took that action, which is limited power, and that I never take that for granted, just so you know, I'm very cautious about the use of that, but we'll do it if it's necessary and appropriate. Then we basically can write an order to that facility. We would ask them or tell them what they do or do not need to do, what actions they should be taking or not taking. And if that is not followed, essentially, our ability there is to write them a citation, which is a fine, essentially, or we could take that case to court. It is not the type of scenario where if they don't follow the order, so let's just say someone's gonna have a mass gathering and we're currently in red. If somebody decided to do that, we can write an order to say, you cannot be doing that right now. The level of viral activity is too high. And unfortunately, we can't bring law enforcement in to actually stop the event. So it is challenging to use that authority in the right way when it's absolutely necessary.
That's Jen Rombalski, the County Health Director in La Crosse County. Coming up on the program, we're going to hear from Dr. Joseph Podoruca of the Mayo Health System. We'll talk to him about how the healthcare system, particularly Mayo, is handling the caseload for COVID-19. It had been low. We'll talk to him about his speculation about what's going to happen in the future and get some reminders about how people can stop the spread of the virus. That's all coming up right here on Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you so much for joining us. We have heard from the County Health Department in La Crosse about a steep increase in the cases of COVID-19 and how the county is recommending that businesses react to that and the precautions that people should take in public. And we turn our attention now to healthcare and one of the prominent providers in our area is, of course, the Mayo Clinic Health System. And joining us today is Dr. Joseph Podoruca, who's the chair of critical care and pediatrics at Mayo. Dr. Podoruca, thank you very much for joining me today on Newsmakers.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much.
We've heard a little bit about some guidance for people, what they should be doing, and we'll ask you a little bit about how those kinds of precautions help to slow the spread of COVID-19. But let me just ask you what we've been seeing through the course of this since March, since the first case in the La Crosse area. We've seen low hospitalizations, and even now, as far as La Crosse County residents who are hospitalized, there aren't any as of our taping late on Thursday. So how is your system doing in terms of dealing with the caseload related to COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fortunately, early on, we mobilized a lot of our resources in the event there would be a significant surge. Fortunately, with the quarantine period, we did not see a big uptick in our inpatient hospitalized sick COVID patients. But as the numbers, like you mentioned, have increased and some of those measures to reopen things have come into play, we have been ready for the second wave. And I think we're starting to see a reflection of that in those numbers that you mentioned. And with that said, we've tried to find unique ways to kind of slowly be diligent and also try to harness our resources in an equitable way. Some of the things that we've done in planning include a tiered opening of multi-level ICUs, including a second, third, and fourth ICU if needed, leveraging that valuable resource, those mechanical ventilators, if those patients need some respiratory support, and then coming up with unique ways to recycle that protective equipment, that PPE, as you call it, the masks and the goggles and the dressings, to make sure our staff are protected, but also to avoid risk of transmission to patients. I think we've created a culture here at Mayo of safety, but we're kind of taking it to the next level now, and that includes a few things. One, we are next week, we're going to institute voluntary COVID antibody testing for our staff that are involved in direct patient care. And that serves twofold. One is sort of surveillance and understanding who is exposed, but also two, to add to our plasma donor pool. And I'm sure you've heard in news, this COVID plasma, such an important, rich resource, one of the few resources we have to treat this outside of these experimental medications. We've also continued our drive-through system, and it's been very busy lately, actually. And that's not surprising given the uptick in the cases. In addition, that COVID hotline through Mayo is still open. If there's any questions or concerns or anybody has symptoms that they're wondering about. Lastly, we're still calling for the blood drives here in La Crosse. We've had Versity come. Red Cross is out of Minnesota, but also available as a resource for those in Southeast Minnesota that are close to the area. Really, it's kind of leveraging all the resources and the plans we had put in place early and understanding how the slow play and the slow evolution of this will take place as patients get tested more, as we see a rise in the positive numbers. And ultimately, those patients, the most vulnerable, those with above the age of 60, those with medical problems like heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, we need to be ready for when they get sick. And that's about where we are right now.
So we hear a lot in the news about treatments, experimental and some hyped by one faction of the conversation or another as this could be it, this could be the answer. But really, there aren't, as you mentioned, a lot of medications that are that have been whose effectiveness has been proven. What is a typical, if you can call it that, treatment? What is somebody either in the hospital or as on an outpatient basis, how are they being treated if they come down with COVID-19?
You know, most patients and younger patients, maybe between 20 and 40, are usually minimally symptomatic, so just having some mild symptoms. They typically don't require hospitalization. Those patients that I mentioned that are vulnerable with heart, lung disease, diabetes, they may end up in the inpatient side, typically on a hospital floor, if they require some level of support like oxygen. Now, there are some patients who get sick very quickly and get very gravely ill, requiring that ventilator resource up in the ICU. And, you know, that I think that's still a rare circumstance, but that is where we really need to bust out our heavy guns. It's that patient, or it's the patient that has the potential to get sick. And in that case, we've used some of those novel therapies coming down the pipeline. You may have heard remdesivir in the news. There's some other medications, those biologic medications. Some of those medications like hydroxychloroquine, those are more on the targeting the prophylactic spectrum, preventing transmission, preventing reproduction of the virus causing symptoms. But new in the last week is this use of this very cheap medication. It's a steroid. It's called dexamethasone, and they did a trial and it showed some benefit in symptoms. And we're excited to try to utilize that resource for our vulnerable patients, those that potentially get sick, those that are in the ICU, but still, we're going to need that plasma. I mean, anecdotally here, this is a small case series. I have several patients that have been very sick. They've received the COVID plasma and all have survived. And again, that's not a study per se, but we do believe as critical care physicians and infectious disease therapists that this is an important resource. And we really put it out there in the public to donate. There's a website that's thefightisinus.org where you can go. It's no personal information. And basically you plug in, you know, if you have symptoms, if you had a test, and then your zip code, and tell you exactly where to go to donate plasma. It's quick, easy, protects your privacy. And, you know, that was spurred by the survivors, the survivor campaign, in addition to academics and some businesses. So I think that's going to be the next phase is ramping up that resource.
Talk about that plasma, because I was interested in that when I first heard it. Is it the antibodies that are present for people who have already had COVID-19 that helps somehow in the treatment of it? How is the plasma donation helpful?
Yeah, so we teased with this idea back in that SARS in 2003. They did some case series looking at that plasma for recovered victims of that virus. And we're looking at the same thing here. You've had COVID-19. You've recovered. It's been at least 2 weeks. We think that you've produced these antibodies or these fighting soldiers. We get that resource from you. We screen it, make sure there's nothing wrong with it, and then we provide it as a therapy. And the idea is that these antibodies, these soldiers that have seen the virus before, they see it acutely in the sick patient, and they attack it, and they kill it. One of the issues we've run into is early on is not a lot of people had it, but as more people have had it, including younger people, asymptomatic people in some cases, our donor pool has increased. And it's so important if you think you had it, or, you know, you're exposed to someone that had it, maybe had a cold, that you go to your doctor, you get the test, you can get the antibody test, and then you can see if you're a possible donor. Again, this is a very critical resource. This is cutting edge. And if you have an opportunity to save a life, I mean, this is the time you can make a difference there.
So in addition to people who need treatment for COVID-19, which I know is the aspect that you're properly and primarily involved in, there's this idea of slowing the spread, which had been pretty successful in our area. And then it seems to be now that things are starting to open up and maybe people are becoming complacent, it just seems to be spreading now that there's more opportunity to be less careful. So what's the take-home message for people who are kind of sick of this? I mean, nobody likes this, but they're being told, you know, to take all the precautions. What do they need to do to stop the spread of this? Is it as simple as staying home and washing your hands?
That's a great question. And I can empathize with everybody out there that's feeling cabin fever, and, you know, summer's upon us, and we've been patiently waiting in a quarantine. We have the science to tell us that, you know, washing the hands, using the mask, social distancing, it works. I mean, you can get your risk of transmission down to 5% or less if both you and someone close to you is using a mask. You without a mask, someone else with a mask, it's up in the 20-30%, and then greatly higher if there's no precautions in place. I think it's a matter of humanitarian or civic duty to protect ourselves and avoid the transmission. Again, young people, they're generally asymptomatic. They're not going to get sick. But it's their vulnerable loved ones, you know, grandma, grandpa, aunts and uncles, those with immunosuppressed diseases, those on special medications that suppress their immune system, they're really vulnerable. And, you know, I think collectively as a society and from a humanitarian standpoint, we can easily do our due diligence to try to protect those vulnerable people. But it's really, we're pushing the bread and butter, remain diligent with the safe practices, mask in public, social distancing, avoiding large gatherings, and be patient. The vaccine trials begin in July. So we're being very aggressive about getting that out there. But until that vaccine comes into the fold and is readily available, this is going to be the game.
Now, there are masks that healthcare professionals and industrial workers and so on use that do protect the wearer. But when we talk about masks, we're usually talking about the cloth masks or the paper masks that people have ready access to that they're being encouraged to wear. And there's a lot of miscommunication in the public about who it is that mask protects. So explain how that works. Like when I wear a mask in public, I don't do that to protect me. I do that to keep myself from perhaps unwittingly carrying that disease to other places. Conversely, people who wear the mask in my presence are not doing it to protect themselves. They're doing it to protect me. Talk about how the mask works and why it's effective in helping me from spreading the disease to somebody else, and it may not be as effective in protecting me personally.
You know, the simple mask, the one that they give you at the doctor, or the homemade one, those prevent transmission of your, if you are a carrier or if you are infected, to a certain degree to other people, but also protect you from receiving those aerosols of the COVID virus, getting that into your body. And that's fine. They're not perfect, but they are effective. Then there's the ones like we call it the N95. Those are the heavy duty ones like we would wear if we're going to go in the room with a sick patient, or the ones that the contractors use when they're doing dust generating or procedures. Those generally tend to be more of a one way. So it will protect you from sucking in, but you could push it out. If you have it, then you could potentially spread it. So we really try to, you know, push patients back from wearing those kind of masks to just using the simple face mask. That is all that you would need at this time. We don't need to, you know, be getting on the heavy duty stuff like we would be here in taking care of a sick patient.
And the idea that I don't need to wear a mask because I'm healthy and I'm not afraid of getting the virus. It's not just about my personal freedom. It's I wear the mask not only to protect me, but also to protect others.
Right. And, you know, that's a hard concept to understand. I mean, we don't like to be told what to do as humans, you know, even in school, you know, sitting there listening to the teacher, it's hard to follow rules. You want to do what you want. Americans are particularly independent individuals in this human planet, and they've always been that way. But again, I think it's about civic and societal responsibility, looking at it through a humanitarian lens. We're protecting ourselves, we're protecting others, but we are also protecting those that are most vulnerable within our immediate circle. Again, our loved ones with chronic illness, comorbidities. And when you look ahead of us, right, I mean, this could be the reality of society for the next years to come. And again, until we get that vaccine, this is going to be a big challenge ahead. And I'd be cautious about passing judgment to other people, but just encouraging that really essence of responsibility.
Dr. Joseph Podoruca is the chair of critical care and pediatrics at the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Podoruca, thank you very much for sharing some valuable information with us today.
Absolutely. Stay safe out there.
Yes, sir. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I appreciate your listening. And if you'd like to hear this conversation or a previous program that we've aired, you can find all of those at our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Next, we're turning the conversation toward food supply and the importance of maintaining a local food supply chain, as we've all seen in the last couple of months. And we'll talk about that after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Thank you very much for joining us today. Turning away from the COVID-19 discussion that we've been involved with throughout the first segment of the show, now talking about local agriculture and the importance of supporting the local food production system. And joining me are two people who are intimately involved with that system. We have Gary Craig from Craig's Meats, and we have Richard DeWild from Harmony Valley Farms. And let me ask each of you to just talk a little bit about where your business is located and what kind of products and services you offer. Let's start with you, Richard. What do you do at Harmony Valley Farms?
We raise 100 acres of fresh vegetables, and we also raise small amount of pigs and beef that we sell directly to customers, cut, wrapped, and frozen.
Okay. And what part of the state are you in?
Our address is Viroqua. We're south of Chaseburg, Wisconsin.
Okay. Now, Gary, what about you? What about Craig's Meats? Tell us about your business.
We're located with an address of Mindoro, Wisconsin. We're 10 miles north of Bangor, 10 miles north of Sparta, on State Highway 162. We've been here for over 40 years. We're a meat processing plant. We slaughter, make sausage. We do everything that people need in the meat business and also in the food and catering business.
Okay. Richard, where do you raise lots and lots of vegetables, and you said a little bit of pork and beef. Where do people get your products? Do you have a store on your farm, or are you distributing through farmers markets, or how does your business work like that?
Well, this year, because of COVID, our farmers market is not happening, and we kind of lost our restaurant business, but we're delivering boxes directly to customers to pickup sites weekly, a box of mixed box of vegetables. It's commonly called CSA, standing for Community Supported Agriculture.
Okay, so you have a regular set of subscribers that are kind of part of the program and picking up the produce that you're growing and the other products.
Yes, and then they have the option of meat.
Okay, and Gary, what about you? Craig's Meats. I know you've got a location, and also your products are available in some stores.
Yes, the Woodman stores, Eau Claire or Altoona, La Crosse, a lot of gas stations, not Quick Trips, but the Golden Green, and a lot of small community stores and just smaller stores, about 50 of them in the area.
Now, you talked about you are a full-service meat market and have various kinds of not just like cuts of meat, but also sausages and different things. What would you say is a signature product that people might know you for?
Our sausage. I've been making it for 40 years. We make a lot of different kinds. I make fruit-flavored sausage, so a lot of cran raisins go in, blueberry, all dried product, but it's fresh dried product that goes in, and the flavor, we put extra flavoring in that is real. So if it's blueberry, it's real blueberry infused. But we make every kind of fruit flavor you can just about think of in sausage. So that in itself, plus we use real honey, real cranberries. Everything is real. We buy it locally and supply locally as much as we can.
You know, our economy has, across the board, there's no part of our economy that hasn't been affected by COVID-19. It continues, but especially for the first couple of months as it was hitting Wisconsin, our state was under what's called the Safer at Home order, where a lot of businesses were ordered to shut down or at least reduce the kinds of services that they were offering. Richard, how did that affect your business?
Well, we were considered an essential business, so we made the decision to stay open, and this was right at the beginning of our planting season. I mean, we already had greenhouse full of plants, so we continued as usual, but added a whole bunch of COVID-19 safety things, you know, for our employees, and we limit people coming to the farm. Everybody has their own face masks, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of sanitizing still going on today, every day.
In food production, anything that is touching, you know, something that people are eventually going to eat, I mean, there are precautions that you take in that kind of production environment anyway. So how different is that from what you normally would have done?
Well, we have, you know, a very high regimen of food safety, involves lots of training with our employees that we've done for 20 years. But we added a lot more sanitizing of frequently touched surfaces, and we've really limited our crew has very little contact with the community. So we've been, so far, have managed everybody. We have 50 employees, and everybody's healthy. And we're going to try to keep it that way.
That's good news. Great news. Great news. Gary, what about you? How has Craig's Meats, how was it affected during Safer at Home and even more broadly, even as COVID-19 continues?
Of the two factions that we have here, the catering business, it totally eliminated it. There was not even one job, whether it be wedding or a company job or a funeral or whatever it might be, they're gone. But we have a state inspector here that is right here on site every day that we're working. And just the way we have been taught and have been doing our business with all the sanitation, the only thing extra is we've added extra bottles of sanitizers and things around the area to make sure that it's done not just once in a while, but all the time. And as far as hand sanitizer and stuff like that, just put extra up. But they've been available all the time. So a lot of this didn't change us a lot because we've been doing it and very happy to have an inspector here at all times.
I want to talk to Richard about Harmony Valley Farms. What was the hardest thing to accommodate or the hardest thing about working through the last few months?
I guess the hardest thing was, and Gary mentioned it too, is early on of just not knowing what was coming and trying to understand it and trying to get an education. We spent a lot of time just getting an education and see what other people delivering food and growing food were doing, and came up with a whole bunch of new protocols for our delivery sites to avoid any contact between our customers, you know, one pickup at a time kind of thing. But putting that all together was huge. It was just a nightmare. But once it was done and we, you know, we had the education and we got the system in place, our customers love it. They're really happy. They feel like we're giving them a real safe food alternative that doesn't involve, you know, going into a crowded store.
Richard, when you're working with CSA, where you have people who are expecting a certain volume of produce every month for a certain agreed upon price point or something like that, depending on how your business works, do you have to predict like ahead of time as you're planting? I have this many customers who are expecting this product, and so I need to plant this much of it. Or how does that work when you're deciding what to plant on your acres that are devoted to this?
We definitely are trying to plant for a market that, you know, we pretty much have. So some of our market is wholesale. We talk to our buyers in the wintertime and try to get an idea of how much we're growing for them, and then adding up all of our CSA customers. It's hard. It's very hard. And we've had to make a bunch of last-minute changes because our market's changed. And a lot of it was we've been actually getting some larger orders, wholesale orders, than what we'd planned for. And we've got a substantial number of new CSA members, so we've had to steadily bump up our numbers. But luckily, we had pretty much had enough product. It seems like it's going to work out.
So let me follow up with you on that, because a lot of businesses are talking about how they're doing less and they're having to stretch farther and they're having to cut back. But you're talking about there were, even on the wholesale side, there were larger orders? What was the driving force behind that?
That is a distributor that has a lot of stores, and I don't know if they possibly there have been some disruptions in distribution from a lot of vegetables come from the West Coast, Arizona, Mexico. Mm-hmm. And there's been a little bit of stoppage with difficult with trucking and with large farms that have large crews that get sick. I don't know, you know.
Do you feel like maybe you've earned customers that through maybe they might have been getting their produce somewhere less locally, but you've been able to earn a customer that you might keep for years and years?
I certainly hope that's true. I mean, I think at this point, we're feeding a lot of new people, and hopefully they're happy and stick with us.
We're talking about local food today on Newsmakers, and specifically the local food supply chain and how to become more involved in that. And we have two people who absolutely make their living by it. Richard DeWild of Harmony Valley Farms in Viroqua. We've got Gary Craig from Craig's Meats, and Gary's products can be found at many stores around Wisconsin, and he's got a shop as well that we'll talk about in just a moment. You're listening to Newsmakers, and it continues right after this. If you want more information about our program, you can find it on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. Newsmakers continues on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, and I'm joined today by Gary Craig from Craig's Meats and Richard DeWild from Harmony Valley Farms, and I appreciate their joining us. We've been talking in the last segment. We talked a little bit about each person's business. We talked a little bit more in depth about how Richard has made some adjustments in order to accommodate larger wholesale orders, and actually had some aspects of the business where there's been a little bit more demand owing to COVID-19 and other things being more difficult to talk about. Gary, I want to talk to you about some new customers and people that you've been seeing who are used to just going to the grocery store and pick up a pre-packed, pre-wrapped package of whatever kind of meat. And we were talking the other day about how these people, some of them are finding their way into Craig's Meats for the first time, and they're not quite sure how to handle that. So why don't you give us a little bit of a primer about, as a new customer coming into a shop like yours for the first time, what do I need to know to make an order from you?
I guess primarily you can do it by phone, or you can come into the front. Ask for it. We're going to go to the back. We're going to cut the fresh steaks as you want them. So if you want them a half inch, you want them an inch, three quarters, whatever it is, you're going to get what you want. And you can watch them and look at the steaks or whatever it is being cut and take it out like that. Or they're frozen ahead of time, because usually if we cut them enough ahead in the morning, by the time 2 hours passes and the quick freeze units we have, this stuff is frozen quite hard, which it gives us shelf stability, and it also gives the consumer all the shelf stability that they need. So either way, but the customers don't have to worry and can come in here freely and make their contact with us, and once it's made, we've got it, we'll do it for them and right to their whatever they want.
Now, if somebody wants, 10 pounds of something to make burgers with, or meatloaf, or whatever, or they want some steaks, or they want some pork chops, and they know what they want, and they want to order it like that, that's one thing. Now, a lot of people are now maybe for the first time exploring the idea of buying a half of a cow, or a half of a pig, or a quarter of one of those. So how does that work, and what kind of instructions do you need from them in order to make that happen for their family?
Well, those kind of people have to call ahead. And we order directly from the farmer in the area, or one of the farms in the area, and we cut it special to their cut request. If they want a half of a half cow, that's what they're going to get. We find somebody to divide with them that's got the same kind of cuts, and we cut it to their to those two people's specifications. And same way with a half a pig, usually we'll cut it their way, but if they want a whole pig, it's cut the way they want it, not the way we want to cut it. And whether it's hams, bacons, or anything like that, it's all done the way they want it.
So what are, I'm one of the up to now I'm one of the go to the grocery store and grab what looks good guys. So what are the varieties of, like, if I'm getting a half a pig, for example, what are some of the things that I might choose to have it cut a certain way versus another way?
Well, pork chops, for example, bone in versus boneless pork chops, hams fresh, uncured. Or cured, smoked, bacons. It can be side pork, or it can be the bellies made into bacon, or, for instance, sausages. We can make their grindings all into brats or bulk brats or bulk pork sausage. Anything that they can buy in a grocery store, they can have it made in, out of their own meat that they're buying. So pretty much even meatloaf or types of sausage, if they got a cow and they want wieners made, they can have it. They can have anything they want out of their own meat. So.
Richard, what about the meat side of your operation? You said you do mostly veg, a little bit of pork and beef. How much of your business is comprised of meat production?
It's probably less than 20%. We depend on a small processor in Cadott, Wisconsin, to process for us according to, you know, our customers' directions. Same as Gary's talking about the choices, and then we deliver it to our CSA sites.
Gary, what about let's talk about I want to find out about the vegetable prices as well and how those are determined. But I know a lot of people were shocked during the initial weeks of COVID-19. There were huge runs on the grocery store. There were aspects of some meat operations nationally that were shutting down due to large numbers of illness in their factories and everything. And all of a sudden, people going to the grocery store were shocked at how the price of meat had skyrocketed and the availability. How does that affect a shop like yours, Gary, when the price is so unstable?
Very bad. It's been to where, in one day's time, when I buy tonnage and have to buy it because I can't get enough animals butchered because I'm trying to help the farmers in the area, and I got to buy in an extra 1,000 pounds of meat. Just last Friday, I had bought in an extra 1,000 pounds of meat to cover my orders. And in doing so, just from that morning to that night, there was a $500 difference in that 1,000 pounds of product. So how do you plan for that? There is no plan. You can lose a lot or you could gain some. So you never know how at any time to handle any of this. And right now, as far as us in the catering business, we haven't had to buy any vegetables, so I haven't been in that market at all. And that would be Richard to tell you what's happening, you know, with that, because we haven't done it. So other than me going to a grocery store and buy it for ourselves, we haven't had any issues with it.
Richard, what about the vegetable side of things? Have you seen the large fluctuations in prices that have been rampant in the meat industry?
Probably not as dramatic, but our prices are pretty much negotiated in the wintertime. So before this ever started, our CSA members were promised a price and signed up. So our prices really haven't changed. We'd be hesitant to take advantage of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Seems like price gouging can easily happen in this situation. But on the other hand, we are absorbing a lot of extra expense.
Do you think that you're going to have to take some of those expenses that you're eating this year and sort of build that into next year's operation?
Hopefully that's the way it'll work. If people are happy this year and we raise the price a little bit next year, they'll all say, yes, no problem.
Gary, as you've seen your prices fluctuate for the products that you're purchasing to make your operation run, and also, you know, your customers may be experiencing some of that on their end as well, what product adjustments have you made, or have you been able to push different products that the customers have been satisfied with that they might be able to achieve at a little lower price?
Yes, especially steaks. Steaks have been a lot cheaper. I've been selling ribeyes for $7.79 on special at $7.29 if they take a whole loin. Well, just in 3 hours, it was over a week ago on a Saturday morning, I cut between 1,000 and 1,500 steaks. So that in itself shows you that the price is very low comparatively to a lot of your larger stores than that. But I'm going to tell you, a lot of this cost, too, that we're enduring right now is coming from the rendering companies, because we've been able to sell hides and sell the bones and the fat and everything, and they used it for max fat and et cetera, et cetera. But now, to get rid of a beef hide, they're charging us $4. They're charging us for the blood to get rid of, the bones to get rid of, everything at all. Plus, they're charging us a stop charge, and they're charging us $10 a stop just for, because they got to have extra sanitizers. So we're getting charged quite a big sum that we weren't being charged before.
So what used
we're
to be
talking hundreds.
What used to be a product that you could sell in addition to the meat that you offered your customers has now become a disposal liability.
Yeah, and it was, at one time, hides were $50. And so they don't want deer hides, they don't want cow hides, they don't want any of that stuff.
Wow.
And if it's chicken, or we do emu and ostriches, we got to dispose of the feathers because they don't want them because it plugs up their equipment.
Mm.
So it's gotten to be pretty bad. You know, we got to watch what we do and guarantee it too. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate the time that you've spent with us today educating our audience and me, frankly, about what you do and how it all works. I want to give you each an opportunity to let everybody know how they can find your products, how they can locate your store, how they can become members of whatever it is you're doing. Let's start with you, Gary. Tell us about Craig's Meats, where people can find it, your website, how they can contact you.
My daughter has it on Facebook. She also has a website with Craig's Meats and Catering. And we're north of Bangor. We're north of Sparta, Wisconsin. So if you're coming from La Crosse, you turn onto 162 north, and we're 10 miles. If you're coming from Black River, you take 27 or 71. So it's all state highways. We are on a state highway and quite easy to find. But we are also in a lot of grocery stores. We're in a lot of small grocery stores. Plus, we're in Woodman's in Altoona. We're in Woodman's in Onalaska, Wisconsin. And a lot of the Green and Gold gas stations were in the area, all the way from Holman, Galesville, and other small stores in the area, too. So we're here from 8 to 5 every day. And I live right next to it, so if somebody needs something, I always try to help them out.
That sounds.
The fact we're here from 8 to noon on Saturdays now, and during catering, we're usually open a lot later because they got to be here anyway.
Well, that's good information. Richard, what about Harmony Valley Farms? Tell us how people can get in touch with you.
Best is our website. Our CSA sign-up is on there. Our meat order form is on there. And all of we deliver in Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Madison, Wisconsin, local area around La Crosse and Viroqua, and some in Chicago. Also, there's a list of stores that we sell to that People could find our product.
And where's that website?
HarmonyValleyFarm.com.
All right. Richard DeWild with Harmony Valley Farm. Also, Gary Craig from Craig's Meats. Guys, thank you very much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ezra.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like more information about our program or to submit an idea or a question for a future show, all of our contact information is on the website WPR.org/newsmakers. You can also subscribe to our show by opening your favorite podcast platform and search for Newsmakers and hit subscribe. I would thank you very much for doing that. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.